The Urban League of Portland Career Connections job fair features government, nonprofit, and private sector employers from around the Pacific Northwest who are looking for employees. Again, that's the Urban League Career Connections job fair on Tuesday, April 2nd from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 1st, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Flash Gordon, the 1980 camp superhero film where Flash tries to save Earth from attacks by Emperor Ming the Merciless of the planet Mongo. Again, that's Flash Gordon showing Monday, April 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, it's Hard Knock Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before. Never been done
in this
before.
Country. In this country.
Here on the Pacifica Network. Up next on the program, we'll discuss how the town of LaGrange in Georgia is disenfranchising its low-income residents through court fines via utility accounts. All this and more ahead, so keep it locked.
Yeah, what's really going on? This is Boost from the Coup with Hard Knock Radio. You gotta be there.
What up, y'all? It's Aya Sage, a.k.a. Rocky Rivera, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. Up next on the program, we'll look at what's happening in LaGrange, Georgia, where the small town is collecting court fines via utility accounts of its lowest income residents. It denies utility entry to undocumented immigrants by requiring a social security number from residents applying for utilities. The NAACP and other organizations have filed a lawsuit against the city of LaGrange for discrimination under the Fair Housing Act, saying that denying people water and heat is an extreme form of injustice. Joining joining us now for this conversation by phone to discuss further what's happening in LaGrange is Lewis Raven Wallace. Wallace recently wrote an article titled How a Small Town Bars Residents and Undocumented Immigrants from Water Access. This particular story can be found on Rewire News, and it was originally first published via Scala Wag. So with that said, Lewis Raven Wallace, thank you so much for joining us today here on Hard Knock. First question, explain for the listening audience, what's actually happening regarding the details in LaGrange and this form of economic violence, especially around court fines that are being attached to the utility accounts of low-income residents? Maybe if you can start there and then provide further context to what's actually happening.
So for many, many years, LaGrange has had two policies in place in its utility department. And the first one, it happens in a lot of places actually, is that they have been denying people utility accounts completely if they don't have a social security number or they choose not to share their social security number. And the result of that is that it's discriminatory against people who are undocumented, who either just simply don't apply because they see that the application asks for that, or apply and are rejected. The other policy that is a lot more unusual, as far as we know, that LaGrange has had in place for a long time, is this really sort of strange debt collection policy in which the municipal court turns over information to the utility department about people with unpaid fines in the court. And then the utility department places those fines on people's utility bills. So you had a traffic ticket that went unpaid, you had a marijuana possession fine that went unpaid, you're on probation, you didn't completely pay off your probation fees, and those fines show up on your utility bill when you open an account. And so the effect that that has is making it very difficult for the poorest people in LaGrange, disproportionately African-American residents of the city, to open utility accounts at all or to remain in their homes once these fines and fees start showing up. And most of the fines and fees from the municipal court are for these sorts of offenses like the ones I mentioned, you know, driving without a license, speeding tickets, left turn where there is a no left turn sign, marijuana possession, and now there's a new law regarding pit bull licensing. So, like, a lot of people are getting fined for their pit bulls. So it's that kind of stuff, and then it ends up resulting in you can't have water or electricity.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, this is a conversation about punishment of poverty, and that, you know, in many cases, these cities, we're looking at LaGrange, but this has happened in Ferguson, this has happened in Flint, Arkansas, and other states throughout the country, that you have municipalities and the cities basically using people who are in the worst shape financially as their personal piggy banks. Maybe if you can talk a bit about the way in which cities are using this way as a using these policies as a way to generate revenue.
Yeah, absolutely. So LaGrange has a fairly standard set of practices around the municipal court, which is to charge these, you know, probation fees and fines, and most of those disproportionately are going toward the most low-income people in the first place. These are quote-unquote crimes of poverty for the most part. And, you know, and also there's disproportionate policing in the poorest neighborhoods, which are the African-American neighborhoods of the city. And that's a practice that we've seen all over the place. I would say LaGrange doesn't operate quite the way we saw like a Ferguson operating in terms of bringing in lots and lots of extra money through those policies or sort of using the fine and fee system for like additional extortion revenue creation. What's really unusual in LaGrange is that almost the entire city budget is funded by the utility department. And so LaGrange owns its water, electric, and gas, and charges fairly standard rates for those, runs them like a business, a small monopoly, and makes a lot of money, a lot of surplus. And that's the money that's funding most of the city's other services, non-utility services. So that's sort of a weird quirk about this story, is that it's the utility department that's sort of doing these extortionary practices and creating this really regressive revenue system that, you know, disproportionately charges the lowest income people. But it's a little bit more disguised in a certain way than some of those direct kind of like court collection things. So rolling over the court fees onto the utility bills is this part of that. And I think what it ends up creating, and I saw in my reporting there, what ends up creating is this immense amount of stress and instability and insecurity sort of layered on in the city for the folks who are already living the most precarious lives in terms of where money comes from and where employment comes from.
As I read your article, and what you're saying is that this is not unusual and it's not illegal, but it's maybe more unethical the way in which they're going about handling things there.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, the lawyer for the city of LaGrange is the person who talked to me from the city, because the city has been sued by the local and state NAACP and an organization called Project South, as well as some immigrant rights activists. There's a lawsuit over both of these policies, the court debt policy and the Social Security policy. The lawyer for the city said in the oral arguments at the Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, he said, "I'm not here to argue whether this is a good policy or not. I'm here to argue whether the policy is legal, and we believe that it is legal and that it's not discriminatory under the Fair Housing Act." So nobody from the city of LaGrange has gone on record saying we think this is a really good policy, or that's just been a no comment. But their argument certainly is that it is totally legal to collect debts in this way.
I have a problem with it. I mean, even though, as you pointed out, what's happening in LaGrange is different from Ferguson, but to me, it all reeks of the same smell. And it's definitely, for me, it feels like it's connected to, you know, this history of racism in this country. I'm thinking about how, you know, following the Civil War, Southern states enacted black codes to subjugate, you know, slaves and maintain this pre-war racial hierarchy. And they would produce certain provisions, you know. And I think this is just another example, because we see who it's greatly impacting. And the fact that if I miss a fine, if I don't do certain things, right, that I might lose my access to water or utilities. I mean, it lacks a level of humanity.
Yeah, and the NAACP activist who I interviewed for this story, Ernest Ward, who was the president of the local NAACP, talked about that a lot and said, you know, it's just so clearly inhumane, and the racial dynamics and the racial segregation in the city make it so that the people who are enforcing these policies are not sort of talking to or listening to the people who the policies directly affect. And he said, you know, that goes way back into the deepest roots of white supremacy in this city, in that every time that the black community in LaGrange has had to argue for civil rights and basic humanity, it has depended on the courts, it's depended on outside intervention, and just how dehumanizing that dynamic is over time. In terms of, Ernest Ward talked about, you know, he's a Christian, he was like, if you believe in love your neighbor and that kind of stuff, it's, you know, it's really frustrating and scary, because this is a small city, this is folks who live really, really close to each other. Another source of mine named Anton Flores, who's an immigration activist and runs a refuge, a sort of house of refuge in the city of LaGrange, talked a lot about the history of utilities as a form of social control. So there's like the extortion piece, you know, like we saw in Ferguson and other places, of using court debts to get money out of people. But then there's this other piece that's about sort of keeping people's lives precarious. And he lives on a block where the block used to be entirely black residents in the middle of the wealthy white side of town. It was like a black enclave, and everyone who lived there worked in the white people's households. And for many decades, nobody on that one block had water or electric at all. Well, they worked in households that had water and electricity. And then eventually over time, they started to get that. and those old homes that were, lived in by black people but owned by white people were gradually removed and demolished. And the last man on the block, a black man who owned his own home outright, he didn't want to leave. He didn't want this block to be redeveloped. And the story goes that the developers collaborated with the city to cut off his water and electric access so that he would leave. And so utilities being used as this form of sort of keeping people in their place has a long history in LaGrange that a lot of people will tell you about. And the undocumented community sees that in a different way now, because you have a lot of people there who can't get a utility account at all. And so they're depending on someone else, whether it's a friend or a neighbor who has legal papers, or their landlord, to sort of help them live in a place even though they can't open a utility account. And that means that they can be extorted directly by their landlords or by other sort of middlemen.
Right. As you mentioned, I mean, looking at the immigrant community there in LaGrange, it's disproportionately impacting a certain segment of the population, be it immigrants or African Americans. Maybe if you can explain for the listening audience how disproportionately and that this is impacting, because I know in the article you mentioned that 90% of the residents subjected to this court debt policy were black, which is the city's population is just 48% black, but we're talking about 90% of the residents who are actually being impacted. I mean, when we talk about the lack of fairness and how this is definitely an extension of institutional racism, there's a clear level that it's happening in some areas, but not others.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at a map of LaGrange, and this came out of a news report from the local newspaper, the LaGrange Daily News, a couple of years ago, they mapped out the households that had been affected by specifically the city's court debt policy. So the policy where the city passes on debt from the municipal court onto people's utility bills. And they mapped out which households had, seen those charges on their utility bills over a period of time. And on the map, it's like looking at a redlining map, a racial segregation map. Like, all of the dots are in the black neighborhoods, 90% of the dots that show up. And so it's really only in specific neighborhoods. It's the lowest income, it's black neighborhoods, and that's reflective of like a systemic racialized class inequality. And also just the ways in which black people in LaGrange don't have a safety net. And the city is sort of working against that instead of for that, for those residents.
Right. Lewis, explain for our listening audience the ways in which the black and Latino communities have organized to really address this issue. And then also, has there been any pushback or retaliation based on the activism that's happening around this particular issue? Because as you've said in this conversation that, LaGrange is unique, but most of the money that they make from, if not all of it, because there's no property tax, and the utility or the municipality is basically paying for everything, which is also the police department. So maybe if you can explain what's been happening on that end.
Yeah, so the reason that there's a legal case over this at all was because the NAACP locally heard about it. And Ernest Ward, who I interviewed from the NAACP, said when he first heard, it was at an MLK Day event years ago, he first heard about this policy, somebody came up to him and said, my court fines are on my utility bill. And he said, Ernest Ward thought the man had to be confused. He just couldn't even understand that that could be what was going on. And so it took a few times of hearing about this from different people to finally realize, oh, this is actually happening, and it's not happening to middle-class black folks either, right? Because they're less likely to just to have these fines that are like $200, $300, $500 you couldn't pay. And so the folks at the NAACP finally kind of got it and said, whoa, this is weird. And they reached out to the statewide NAACP and eventually to some lawyers in Atlanta with Project South and the Southern Center for Human Rights, and developed this into a lawsuit. At the same time, they ended up connecting with local immigrant rights activists who were really concerned with Central American, Latin American It's primarily Mexican and Central American immigrants there, who many of whom had faced this other related utility policy that's discriminatory. And so they had a couple of public meetings. Ernest Ward told me that the first of those public meetings about the court debt policy, a lot of people didn't come because they were afraid that it was some kind of trap, because this is all people who, like, they know that they owe money to the city, you know? And so they were afraid to come, but then word got around that it was like a legit community meeting and not a trap of some kind. And so people started showing up. And I think there are some similar dynamics in the undocumented community of fear, right, about even coming to a community organizing space or a gathering. But there have been a number of public gatherings, and that was how the lawyers from Project South and Southern Center for Human Rights connected with various plaintiffs in the case. There are 8 plaintiffs in the case, all of whom are people who have agreed essentially to, you know, to be activists and be advocates so that they can try to make change around this issue. All the undocumented plaintiffs are, you know, John Doe or Jane Doe in the case, but the court debt policy folks have their names on it and have really spoken out. One of them is actually, one of the plaintiffs is a landlord who, she has, you know, a bunch of tenants, and she says over the years, hundreds of people have come to her saying, I'm having this problem with my utilities. They're going to get cut off, or I can't open a utility account because of a court debt. And that over the years, she has discounted people's rents in the amount of thousands of dollars in order to make it so that they wouldn't have to lose their housing over this policy. So she's actually a plaintiff in the case and somebody who's spoken out about it, having seen it happen to people who are renting from her in LaGrange. But yeah, it's a hard, it is a small community. It's a hard place to speak out. There is a history of backlash and retaliation for people who speak out against kind of the white supremacist power structures, and there's a lot of fear. So definitely the people who agreed to speak for this story were doing it in the face of that, and I'm very grateful for that.
Right. You know, historically there has been this need to separate struggles, be it that of African Americans, of Latino folks, indigenous folks, and so on and so forth. Do you see, based on the work that you, the research that you've done and the work that went into producing this particular story on LaGrange, do you see that there's that these two separate communities, immigrant communities and the Black community, drawing these immediate parallels and then also building strong coalitions out of it?
Definitely folks are identifying the parallels between the struggles of Black and Brown communities in LaGrange, and that's something that I think the lawyers in the case have said to me, you know, if that's the only thing that we accomplish here, even if we don't win this case legally, just helping to make that connection and helping to sort of bring some of that solidarity into play is a really important piece. And I think utilities are a really interesting kind of meeting point for that, right? Because it's such a basic part of everyone's day-to-day life, and yet it's this place where all of this inequality is playing out. And it affects these communities in really different ways, right? But there's a connection, and that connection is made in the legal argument around the Fair Housing Act, which, you know, says that you can't discriminate in access to housing for race, and disproportionate impact is enough to flag a problem under the Fair Housing Act. And so, you know, definitely they've made that connection. I think the building over time, it takes time, and like I said, the folks who live in LaGrange are up against a lot in terms of a culture of silence.
Well, I have 2 more questions, and then we'll end this conversation. You mentioned the legal issues regarding LaGrange, what's happening in LaGrange, and the attorney said himself that, you know, we don't know if we'll win this, but based on what recently happened regarding the Supreme Court ruling against high fines and civil asset forfeitures, do you see this actually aiding in maybe the possibility of them winning this particular case?
I don't know, because I haven't looked at that case. I know that where this case sits now is with a 3-judge panel in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, which includes 1 Trump appointee and 1 Reagan appointee and 1 Clinton appointee. the Trump appointee in particular is, I think, quite likely to side with a pretty narrow reading of the Fair Housing Act. But we still don't know what will happen there based on that three-judge panel.
Well, and then also, okay. And my last question is, I know that you've been following this for quite some time, and not too many outlets have been reporting this particular story, what's been happening in LaGrange. How did you first become familiar or aware of what was taking place? Because you've been a huge advocate, I would say, in the sense of getting this story out to the masses.
I was actually doing a story about undocumented immigrants who were wearing ankle monitors and being forced to pay for those ankle monitors themselves under a policy of ICE of working with private ankle monitor companies. So Immigration Customs Enforcement has people like all over the country who are being monitored on electronic ankle monitors, and you know, this company or a number of different companies make money off of it. So I just happened to be interviewing a source in LaGrange who had had that experience with the ankle monitors. And through that, I connected with a man named Anton Flores, who runs Casa Alterna, which is this refuge house in LaGrange. I was on the phone with him, and he was like, you know, while you're down here, because I'm coming from North Carolina down to Georgia, he's like, while you're down here, you need to know about this crazy thing that's happening in this city with the utility bills. And he told me the story about it. He was like, people's court fines and fees are being rolled over onto their utility bills. And I had the same reaction as the folks from the NAACP and sort of everyone else who first hears about that, which is like, really? Really? You know, and I looked it up and I saw that there was this court case, and I saw that there hadn't been very much national coverage, hardly any at all, actually. Strangely, LaGrange was in the national news in early 2017 when the white chief of police issued a public apology for a lynching that had occurred in LaGrange in 1940. And there was like a media tour, like national media from all over the country. I don't know that they came to LaGrange, but they called the chief of police and they called the NAACP and they did this story about racial reconciliation and this lynching apology in LaGrange. And it was like, this is so exceptional. This is the only time that that we know of that a police department has apologized for a lynching, and it was exceptional. And so it was national news. And at the same time, LaGrange has this exceptional local policy of discrimination in its utilities that reminds people of Ferguson. It reminds people of Flint, right? It's, I think, should be a national story. And that was something that national outlets all over the country had completely overlooked when they reported this lynching apology. And so that, to me, was just this kind of troubling example of like how the national media might like fetishize one sort of exceptional story about race in this country and totally ignore another sort of exceptional story. And I think the story, that this story about the utility policies, requires us to look at, as you said, systemic racism and, you know, how white supremacist policies that go all the way back to slavery and Reconstruction are still in place in a certain way. And that's like a harder conversation than the conversation about apologizing and reconciling, right? And so that's been, I mean, that's just like where my mind has been this whole time, wanting to expose this thing, not because I think LaGrange is like extra bad or extra special, but because I think it's reflective of a bunch of dynamics that are actually happening in all kinds of cities and towns, and often, like Ernest Ward from the NAACP said, don't change without some kind of external intervention.
Absolutely. Aren't you working on a book as well?
I am. My book is called The View from Somewhere, Undoing the Myth of Journalistic Objectivity. So it's very much about journalists who take a stance, and in particular journalists who try to be sort of on the side of dismantling white supremacy and challenging the status quo, and what the consequences have been for journalists who have taken that sort of stance over the years.
And when will this book be released or coming out?
It's going to be out in October 2019 from University of Chicago Press.
All right. Again, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today here on Hard Knock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else? Just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock. Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they Hard Knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat it and any from the steel grave. They'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I made with a beat. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, Nita and Davey D.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it,
girl. East Coast.
Reparations? In order to get the job done, maybe it's time to call it something else. The moral justice of the reparations proposition is unassailable. Millions were murdered, transported across oceans, worked to death, starved, abused, raped, their labor, their loved ones, their children stolen from them, and their descendants selectively disadvantaged down to this very day. They deserve to be made whole. It's only justice, and it's only right to try to correct this historic wrong. The reparations demand is not new. It was embodied in the effort of some Union generals in the Civil War who redistributed land confiscated from slave masters. That's where the slogan 40 acres and a mule comes from. President Andrew Johnson vetoed legislation to give the freed slaves the land they had worked on and quickly reversed the policy almost every place it had been enacted. In the 1890s, the reparations demand surfaced again with proposals to grant pensions and land to surviving former slaves and their families. Again, there was powerful opposition from the planter class, since most African Americans were agricultural and domestic workers in the South, and all the pension bills died in committee. The modern reparations current, and I call it a current to distinguish it from a movement, everything claims to be a movement these days, that current begins with James Forman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, whose 1969 Black Manifesto demanded $500 million from white churches and synagogues to be handed over to philanthropic trusts, to a Southern land bank, to printing, publishing, and other projects, including the National Welfare Rights Organization. In 1980 and 1987, the federal government awarded reparations to a small group of Native Americans, a tiny, tiny fraction of First Nations people slaughtered and dispossessed, and to 60,000 survivors and descendants of Japanese Americans stripped of their property and interned during World War II. In 1987, NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, was founded. And in 1989, Detroit Congressman John Conyers introduced a reparations study bill in Congress. It went nowhere. Conyers resubmitted that reparations bill each and every congressional session until 2007, when he finally became chair of the House Judiciary Committee. That bill sat in his desk drawer during the next 4 years while he actually had the power to pass it out of committee. once Conyers was safely out of power in 2011, he resumed the submission of his reparation study bill to each successive Congress until his forced retirement last year. Again, the moral correctness of the reparations proposition is unarguable. People were wronged, their descendants were wronged, and they deserve to be made whole. Only a fool can argue with that. But something else has changed here. Reparations agitation in the 19th century arose directly from former slaves, from the black working class. 19th century reparistas, if I can call them that, were all about the practical politics of assembling political coalitions which might do the heavy political lifting needed to carry out reparations for African Americans. And although they did fail, they were seriously about the politics and about the implementation. The reparations current of the 20th and 21st century is something altogether different. To begin with, the modern reparations current did not originate with the black poor, with the black working class. No disrespect to the late Brother Foreman, but the modern reparations current originates from the class of what Adolph Reed calls professional race managers, the cohort of relatively educated and affluent African Americans who assumed the roles of spokes Negroes, allegedly representing the rest of us. In the 1960s and the 70s, some of us fought for the inclusion of the histories, the writings, and the scholarship of people who looked like us in the academic canon. One outcome of those struggles is the career of a class of black academics who have adopted the morally just reparations arguments and extended them into the realms of psychology and spiritual well-being. There is a truly vast amount of academic and popular writing from dozens, perhaps hundreds, of black academics and professionals who insist that the pursuit of reparation and the attainment of apologies for slavery and Jim Crow are crucial, are absolutely vital and indispensable to the spiritual and psychological well-being of African Americans. You can find their views exhaustively examined in Psychology Today, in the Journal of the American Psychological Association, and in writings and statements of African American psychological organizations and psychiatric organizations. Some would have us believe that the current reparations demand arises from the most politically advanced sectors of black American thought and political action. I'm not buying that. I can't really prove it, but I suspect that a lot of the young people currently flying the Reparations Now flag learn to first consider reparations as a moral and as a political proposition from black academics, not from the broad masses of our people. The trouble is that all a moral proposition needs to justify itself is to be right, while a political proposition must be made to happen in the real world, a world which is frequently indifferent or hostile to moral propositions. In the political world, a 21st century appeal for reparations is pathetically easy for our enemies to twist into something for those undeserving people and nothing for you real American white people. The worldwide political reality is that special policies aimed at special constituencies make for the easiest targets. Medicaid, for instance, has proved trivially easy to shrink and to shred and to even deny eligibility to most of those who should qualify for it, because Medicaid is aimed exclusively at poor people, popularly but incorrectly assumed to be mostly black. France has universal daycare from infancy to about age 4 for everybody, whether you're a working mom, disabled, or a billionaire. That's what makes it politically bulletproof, the fact that everybody's in and nobody's out. The same inclusive model protects the free at the point of service medical care systems of Britain, Canada, and other places. Once we untangle the moral and psychological parts of reparations from the political task of making reparations happen, we are faced with a political problem. The only two times black people in this country made significant material advances were during the Civil War and early Reconstruction, and during the brief heyday of the Freedom Movement, when Jim Crow was largely dismantled from about 1960 to maybe 1975. In both cases, the forward progress only lasted as long as a large plurality of white support backed black aspirations. When that plurality of white support eroded, the period of progress abruptly ended. Our modern reparistas focus upon the spiritual and psychological, only this and many apologies will make us whole, facets of reparations, while they take no responsibility for even identifying the vaguest of roadmaps, naming the constituencies we'd have to persuade to our side to make the political heavy lifting of reparations possible. The politics of most of our reparistas do espouse pretend that there are no class distinctions inside black communities, even though the gaps between the richest and the poorest American blacks are larger than the gaps corresponding between American whites. Many modern advocates of reparations are straight-up opportunists, like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who deploy reparations rhetoric as a counter to socialism. There's a reason why many of Chicago's most prominent reparistas supported Rahm Emanuel in the last mayoral election. The Conyers reparations bill and other stunts like it are great things to hide behind, with no thought of ever achieving results. So the notion that the reparations demand arises from the most politically advanced sectors of the black community is at best highly questionable. The fact is that Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, as explained by Glenn Ford this week in Black Agenda Report, legalized unions with the unrestricted right to strike, and the forgiveness of student debt would all disproportionately benefit African Americans. Which demographic segment has the highest per capita student debt? It's black women. Black people are disproportionate victims of predatory student, medical, housing, and consumer debt as well. We were represented far higher than our share among the home foreclosures of 2006 to 2009. And black women are the most likely demographic segment to form and to join a fighting union. Again, the reparations proposition is entirely morally justified. But the political atmosphere is not a neutral place where arguments prevail because they are righteous. We live in the place where 60 million people voted for Trump, and where we cannot even marshal the plurality of white support for affirmative action, a far lower hurdle than reparations. A sober assessment of current political reality seems to indicate that a dogged insistence on calling the policies of fairness, equity, and justice by that name may be a big impediment to the heavy lifting it takes to enact them. It's not rocket science. People are clever enough to talk and to listen in code all the time. And though large majorities of black people do support reparations when pollsters ask the question, they are far more likely to be attracted to results than they are to the label. So what if we just did the work to make this stuff happen, but we didn't call it reparations? For Black Agenda Radio Commentaries, I'm Bruce Dixon. Black Agenda Report is being censored by Google and other commercial social media, and we have been singled out by anonymous cowards who accuse us of making propaganda for the Russians. So you should like us on Facebook and all, but the only way to guarantee that you are receiving the fresh news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left that we have delivered each and every week since 2006 is to visit our website at www.blackagendareport.com and hit the subscribe button. Subscribing to our free weekly email newsletter is the only way you can get weekly summaries and links to all our weekly posted content neatly packaged for your listening and sharing convenience. To comment on our material, join the conversation on our Facebook page or send us email to comments@blackagendareport.com.
Let us Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, South, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415, bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. Yo, and to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from the hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard side, learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard side.
You know what free is? What's free? Free is when nobody else can tell us what to be. Free is when the TV ain't controlling what we see. Tell my n***a I need you. Do all the fame, you know I stay true. Pray my n***a stay free. Made a few mistakes, but this ain't where I wanna be. Before I'm judged by 12, put a 12 on my feet. Tell my n***a I need you. Stay up, I know these times ain't true. Real life, what's free? Fed investigations, heard they plotting like I trapped. 20 mil in cash, they know I got that up for rap. Maybe it's the Michael Rubens or the Robert Krafts or the billionaire from Marcy in the way they got my back. See how I prevailed and they tried to knock me back. Lock me in a cell for all them nights and I won't snap. 250 a show and they still think I'm selling crack. When you bring my name up to the judge, you tell them facts. Tell them how we funding all these kids to go to college. Tell them how we ceasing all these wars, stopping violence. Trying to fix the system in the way that they designed it. I think they want me silenced. Oh, say you can see. I don't feel like I'm free. Locked down in my cell, shackled from ankle to feet. Judge banging that gavel, turned me to slave from a king. Another day in the bin. I gotta hang from a string. Just from popping a willy, my people run to the city. From a cell to a chopper, if you from the top of the city. You can tell how we rockin' soon as I pop up. We litty poppin' like Pebble in 94. Big poppin' and Diddy and counting me out. Like my account ain't busy, that's 5,000,020. Sit up and count to I'm dizzy. Fade 500,000, 100 round in a stizzy. As we be feeling rapping, I might just pop up with Drizzy. Like, what's free? It's when nobody else can tell us what to be. Free is when the TV ain't controlling what we see. Tell my n***a I need you. Through all the fame, you know I stay true. Pray my n***a stay free. Made a few mistakes, but this ain't where I wanna be. Before I'm judged by 12, put a 12 on my feet. Tell my n***a I need you. Stay up, I know these times ain't true. Real life, what's free?
In the land of the free where the blacks enslave. 3/5 of a man, I believe's the phrase. I'm 50% of Ducey and it's dead free, yeah. 100% of Ace of Spade, worth half a beat. Ooh. Rock Nation, half of that, that's my piece. 100% of title to bust it up with my cheese. Smokes my won't ever work together. You run a checker, but they never give you leverage. No red hat, though Michael and Prince me and Ye. They separate you when you got Michael and Prince's DNA. I ain't one of these house you bought my house like a resort. My house bigger than yours, my spot. Come on, man. My route better, of course. We started without food in our mouth. They gave us pork and pig intestines. You discarded that we ingested. We made the project a wave. You came back, reinvested, and gentrified it. Took sense of pride, now how that's free. And them people stole the soul and hit with 360s. I ain't got a billion streams, got $1 billion. Inflating numbers like we po' be happy about this. We was praising Billboard, but we were young. Now I look at Billboard like, is you dumb? To this day, Grandma afraid what I might say. They gonna have to kill me, Grandmama, I'm not their slave. Check out the bazaar, rapping style used by me. The H.O.V., look at my hair free, carefree. Ain't nan free, enjoy your chains. What's your employer name with the hairpiece? I survived a hood, can't no shaitan rob me. My account's so good, I'm practically living tax free. Factory, that's me. Sold drugs, got away, scot free. That's a CCE, copy, guilt free. Steal me, and expect me to not feel away. To this day, USA, y'all kill me. Sucker free, no shucking me. I don't jive turkey. Say happy Thanksgiving, sound like a murder to me. Smoke free, all of y'all calling out toll free. Label rob you for millions, yet you wanna put a hole in me. Sugar free, season, but I'm salt free. You lay a hand on hold my shoe to shoot for free. I promise World War III. Send an order through a hands free. Kill you in 24 hours or shorter, you can't ignore the hand speed. Oh God, it's off the head, it's improv, but it's no comedy. Sign I fail, hell nah. Ha 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 ha.
Trump in triumph. The news that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller would return no additional indictments and no charges of wrongdoing by incumbent President Donald Trump has hit Washington like a thunderclap. Leading Democratic politicians are in a state of shock, as if they never considered the possibility of such an outcome. Shock and awe abound. Dems, who learned their politics and political classes in college, seemingly never learned the true role of the FBI, which showed in the woeful history of the 1960s that were profoundly political and agents of the imperial executive, as shown by the monstrous attacks on Dr. Martin Luther King, the Black Panthers, and activists from a score of social change groups. They rarely, if ever, attacked the wealthy and powerful. And Trump, equipped with a weapon no president has ever seen before, blasted his way out of what seemed like an insurmountable trap, sending shockwaves once again throughout the system. That weapon? Twitter. With over 50 million recipients, changed the dynamics between the accused and the accuser. For the FBI was formed to serve the imperial executive, not to oppose it. Like a corpulent Roman emperor, Trump plays on the links, while the case against him sinks beneath the green. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Femi Anikulakbokuti, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio. Keep on listening, my friends.
Bonjour, c'est les Nubians.
Vous écoutez Hard Knock Radio, la meilleure radio de la Bay Area.
Yo, 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 que hola, it is Skep Geva Egaro de la FF La Fabricata, escuchando Hard Knock Radio de lunes a viernes 94.1.
Yes, Hard Knock Radio, and this is Vusi Mahlasela.
My life I has to fight. All's my life I. Hard times like yeah, bad trips like yeah. Nazareth, I'm f***ed up, homie, you f***ed up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in a twilight. We're pretty Benjamin is the highlight. I tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy. Tell them all to come and get me, reaping everything I sow. So my karma come in heaven, no preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a f***ing gangsta in silence for the record. Tell the world I know it's too late. Boys and girls, I think I've gone crazy. Trying to side my face, it's all day. Won't you please believe when I say, wouldn't you know, we've been hurt, been down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po when they kill us dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright. To a house, you a car, 40 acres and a mule, a piano, a guitar, anything. See, my name is Lucy, I'm your dog. Motherfucker, you can live at the mall. I can see the evil, I can tell it, I know it's illegal. I don't think about it, I deposit every other zero. Thinking of my partner, put the candy, painting on a Rico. Digging in my pocket, and a profit big enough to feed you. Every day my logic, get another dollar just to keep you in the presence of your chico. I don't talk about it, be about it, every day a sequel. If I got it, then you know you got it, heaven I can reach you. Pet dog, pet dog, pet dog, my dog, that's all. Pick back and chat, I trap the back for y'all. I rap, I black on tracks, so rest assured. My rights, my wrongs, I write till I'm right with God. When you know, we've been hurt, been down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po, when they kill us dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
Tuned to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Let Your Mind Bloom Spring Scientific Fair on Sunday, April 7th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Rosewood Initiative in Portland. Let Your Mind Bloom Spring Psychic Fair features practitioners and healers from many different modalities, as well as local vendors, arts and crafts, and a fairy photo booth. Again, that's Let Your Mind Bloom Spring Psychic Fair on Sunday, April 7th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Rosewood Initiative, 16126 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences between them. Again, that's Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
All of you fascists bound to lose.
I get home from school. My dad said, we're all going to the drive-in. Double features on Monkey's Uncle and the Monkey's Got Home. You wanna go? I said, no thanks. I can think it's about summer. It's almost here. That means I get to spend some time with my lover. Yeah, he's a real dude. With his long hair, bangs, and beer boots. I'm going to the Battle of the Garages tonight. His band's playing. As I'm getting ready, I have to think about tonight. I can just feel the vibrations. I can see the cycle.